free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can get a past lineup of speakers, see who we have coming down the pike, and you can download past shows that we've had here. On October 8, 2008, I had a phone conference with two executives from Millennial Motors, Dennis Palmer, CEO, and Damian Riddock. The call was recorded, and with their permission, it is now being made available for you.
Here's the map on how it comes out. But we've had some engineers from all over the world come and look at this technology. Each one has came up with the same or a very similar statement that this motor does what everybody would like their motors to do, and there's nothing else even close. And that's where we're at.
Give us a recap of what it does, because we don't have a field yet, at least in this context, of what it is that this motor does. How big is it? How much input? How much output? Is it output in the form of electricity? Is it in the form of torque? What is it?
Well, let's back up just a little bit and tell you about how the motor works, and then some of this will start to make some sense, if that's all right. What we do is, if you've ever seen the inside of a conventional motor, what you'll see is you'll see a rotor and a stator that are made out of a whole lot of iron, usually thin laminated sheets that are stacked together. And then around those iron rotors and stators, they have copper windings. And so essentially what they're doing is they're using the electricity passing through the copper windings to create the magnetic field or the magnetic flux. And the iron is then used to transmit that flux from where it is created to where it is used. The problem with that concept, which is, of course, close to a century old, I guess, is that the iron essentially acts kind of like a resistor. So it resists the flow of the magnetic flux. It's very convenient for design purposes because you can move the flux around and, you know, put it exactly where you need it. But from an efficiency and performance standpoint, that iron costs you from an electrical usage perspective. Every time you change the direction of the current, change the direction of the field, you cause the iron to heat up. And so a conventional motor, after it operates for a short time, can be so hot that if you put your hand on it, it burns you. Well, that heat is wasted energy. What we've done is we have built a motor where we eliminate 99% of the iron. And as a result, the energy that goes into heating that iron in the normal motor, that doesn't happen in our motor, and so the efficiencies jump through the roof. Now, it's not just efficiency. When we turn that electrical energy into a magnetic field, which we then use to push off of other magnetic fields, without the iron resistor in the way, we have a stronger field in place. So we get better torque than the conventional motor in the same size or weight package. So we're talking increased electrical efficiency, and we're talking better horsepower to weight ratios, or better torque to weight ratios, or better volume ratios. We get more out of a smaller motor. So there's our fundamental advantage. From an electronics perspective, this motor does require a certain amount of electronics to control the motor. And what we do with those electronics, this comes back to the iron. When we put the energy into our copper coils, when you stop putting energy in, the field then collapses and comes back out, and we can capture that with our electronics. Now, if we had iron in the motor, or a large portion of iron like the conventional motors, when that field started to collapse, it would simply be absorbed into the iron and wasted. So this is another advantage of a combination of not having the iron and having an electronics package that can capture the energy from the collapsing field.
Okay.
And that's where we get our big advantage in terms of capturing what you call environmental energy. Energy that we're putting in, but we get most of it right back out. We do this over and over. During one cycle, we might do it 100 times. And the way the electronics are set up to capture all that, it can push the efficiency absolutely through the roof.
So the question of a typical motor, in this case, is not serving the back end, it's serving as energy that is being put to use rather than wasted?
Yeah, normally that energy would be wasted. It would be used to essentially generate heat. We're capturing it, and we're kicking it back into the next cycle and reusing it.
And do you even call it back EMF?
No. We don't, because back EMF or counter EMF is what, in a conventional motor, prevents the current from flowing through the coil. And because the motion of the motor produces the back EMF due generation, we don't have the same scenario as a typical motor. So if you have a conventional motor and you apply a load to that motor and you start slowing the motor down slower and slower and slower, if you look for the ratings on an electric motor, you'll find what they have, stall current or lock builder current, and it's always multiple times higher than the run current. So much higher, in fact, that if you stall a motor for any length of time at all, the coils melt and the motor's burnt up. Anybody who's worked with electric motors is familiar with that scenario. Our motor, by design, does just the opposite. As we slow the motor down to stall, we have one test where we were running one coil that we were sampling the power consumption of the one coil in the motor. And because of lack of test equipment, we can only do one. But that's the only one we were running in the motor, so there wasn't any other place for it to go. So we were running one coil motor. While we were doing that, we had a load on the motor, and the current draw through that one coil was 1 amp. As we loaded the motor and increased the load on the motor, the current draw continued to get down as the, although the torque increases as we slow the motor down, the horsepower output decreases because our speed is decreasing. By the time we loaded that one coil motor down to the point that it couldn't turn the load, the current draw, instead of being 1 amp and going up to like 10 amps, which would be on a conventional motor.
Could you hold a second? He's calling in here. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, instead of drawing 1 amp of current, as would be in a conventional motor, would go up to like 10 amps. In our situation, that 1 amp, as we loaded it down to stall, went down to 0.2 amps, or 1/5 of its run current. So it was consuming considerable less energy. All of these things add together to an extreme increase in efficiency over a wide range of output. If you were running a motor on batteries, it would be comparable to an incandescent light and an LED. Anybody knows that an LED light produces way more light for a much longer time with the same amount of electricity as an incandescent because of the difference in heat. And that's where we're at.
Okay, so my initial theme was probably a little bit misplaced in saying that you're harnessing environmental energy, because all you're doing is making a more efficient energy that uses the available energy in a more efficient manner without some of the traditional drawbacks of heat with low torque burning up an engine. Your engine with low torque or with low speed, high torque rather than burning up would just be putting a lot of torque out. If you stop the engine, it wouldn't burn up. it would just, until the torque was reduced to the point that the engine, the motor could turn, it would just sit there. It would be consuming energy, but it wouldn't be heating up. Is that correct? Or where would the energy be going?
It consumes a fraction of the energy. So as you load it down to stall, the energy consumption goes down. We can turn that down lower and lower and lower with improvements in the circuit. At this point, we have it to where we're about, at load we'd be about 3 amps, and at stall we'd be about 0.25 amp.
If you're running a rock crusher, for example, and you've got the thing stalled, you want to get the thing moving again, and you want to increase the power so that you can get the belt moving again. You don't want to be reducing the input power. You want to be increasing it. What would that be doing to your motor? Would it be?
Our motor, what happens is the torque output increases dramatically. We can increase the torque considerably because horsepower, which watts is related to horsepower. Horsepower is torque times RPM in a formula. Well, if you're not moving, if you don't have a motion, you're not putting out horsepower. You're just
trying.
Okay? So with our motor, the current draw is related to the horsepower output, as opposed to the regular motor, it's related to RPM. So, in the case of a rock crusher, we have the only motor made that would be able to have a rock in the rock crusher when you turn it on. And it would have the torque ability to just start it and run it without burning up. And it wouldn't dim the lights in the factory while the rock crusher was starting. This would also happen with a conventional motor. So that huge amount of current surge, you go to some big factories and big farms and stuff where they have huge electric motors, a lot of times they'll have what they call a demand meter, which they get charged for the usage rate based on the demand. So not only will this use less energy, considerably of less energy, but it also eliminates the huge demand that's associated with big electric motors. So there's not as big a demand on the power company. Air conditioners, refrigeration units, air compressors, conveyor belts, those types of things which take a large amount of power to start them. We can start them better than they can with their motors, and we don't have the huge current surge to do that.
From a bottom line perspective, we're going to get more torque per amp as compared to the conventional.
Right. When your motor runs, I imagine there's still some heat, but it's just not nearly as much as a normal motor.
It's depending on how efficient we have it set up to run. We can turn it up and force it to get hot by just pushing the power to it. But if we're running it at the mode that it's designed to run at, which is still smaller and lighter than the other conventional electric motors, it produces such a low amount of heat that you can lay your hand on the motor after it's been running for an hour and it'll feel just like slightly warm. And that's without cooling fans, without...
It's so effective that we build a lot of our motors out of plastic, which you would never dream of doing in a conventional motor setting, not the motor.
Yeah, okay. In fact, the core that we wind our coils on is a PVC pipe. If you took a regular motor and you wound it going, you'd run through a piece of PVC pipe that would just melt and fall out.
Yeah.
That's how
what about, while the motor might not be contributing to a heat signature, what about the other components in the system? If you're running it, for example, in an automobile, you've got the heat from the transmission, you've got heat from other components in the system that are going to be providing heat to the system. The motor might not be contributing to that heat, but other things will be. Will it be able to withstand in that kind of environment, or will those types of environments require a non-plastic, non-PVC type of...
We have those options, but the motor itself, even in those environments, still stays very cool.
Yeah, in fact, you were mentioning the heat in the transmission. We've also developed a transmission, that we've eliminated all the bands and all the clutches, and therefore 99% of the heat-producing products in the transmission for use in the electric vehicle, which gives us the acceleration of the vehicle with regular transmission and eliminates the heat associated with it. The problem we're going to have in our vehicle conversion is providing heat for the passengers, because there's nothing in the system that produces enough heat to even think about heating up one person, let alone the entire interior inside the vehicle. So we're looking at
maybe an electrical heater or something.
We've got some electrical heater options where we actually use an electric hot water heater to heat up fluid and have a little circulation pump to pump it through the radiator in the car, the little heating radiator. That's one of the options. We have options of seat heaters. We actually heat the seat instead of the car. We have a little electric heaters that we can put on the dashboard for defrosters. And we also have a propane demand water heater system that we can add with a small propane tank in the vehicle for real cold areas. Anytime you use resistance heat, you're wasting your battery. And to keep our battery life out there as long as we want to eliminate the resistance heat.
Now, there's another point worth mentioning regarding our transmission. It's based on the same concept as the motor, with the addition of gearing, a small amount of gearing. But it's done in an infinitely variable gear ratio kind of a format. And there are mechanical advantages that you can achieve in efficiency beyond the electromagnetic advantages. Those mechanical advantages can easily add up to 20 to 30% right there.
So we were talking before we came on this recorded call about using or dropping this into as a retrofit into an existing vehicle to turn it into a hybrid. Maybe you could talk about that for a minute.
Okay. We have two versions of retrofit. One version we have is we can take a vehicle that has a conventional gas or diesel engine in it, pull the transmission out of that vehicle and put in our transmission, which is a transmission electric motor combination. And with that, we have an instant hybrid vehicle, which uses transmission motor combination to do the starting and stopping. And the gas engine would more closely be used to maintain batteries for long trips cross country, where you can refill easily with liquid fuel.
So would that scenario include a regenerative braking type of system?
Yes. Our motor transmission system has built-in regenerative braking, and it's turned to be very efficient. We're able to produce so far about three times the current that tries to run the motor in the regeneration portion. So we have very good regenerative braking capabilities built in.
And in terms of, you know, people are converting their hybrids into all-electric vehicles, with this system, if somebody threw some batteries in the trunk of the car, would they be able to run it just on the electric motor component without the engine running?
Yes. In fact, if somebody wanted to go to an all-electric, we would put the same transmission in. We would put a smaller electric in front of it, pull their engine and transmission out, and then if they want to go on a long trip, put in a much, much smaller self-contained motor generator or engine generator where the bigger gas engine used to be. And now they'll have the range of the gas vehicle, and they could run all-electric. Unless they're going over like 200 miles or 300 miles, then they would turn on the gas for the duration of the trip.
Just as a tangential note, I might point out that in going from a lower efficiency motor to a higher efficiency motor with lower or higher torque at lower RPM capability, you're basically introducing a solution to the electric motor world that is superior to anything that's out there, given increased range, increased performance, etc. So if people can go further on the same charge, they can go faster on the same charge.
Yeah, further and faster on the same charge. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but we've just been accepted into the XPRIZE competition. We have a company that's building battery technology, but that we're teaming up with for one of our XPRIZE competitions. And that battery technology allows between 5 and 15 minute recharge. And with that technology, married with our technology, not only do we have the extended range of our motor system, but you'll also have the quick recharge that isn't available now in lithium-ion batteries.
Is that a e-store battery?
No, it's a company called Extreme Power. E-store has a technology that's different but similar. And if somebody had access to the e-store battery, that would be a big plus also. But in turn, because e-store was going to have problems keeping up with their production requirements, from what I understand at this point, we've teamed up with a couple of other battery companies that have technologies available now. One will give a quicker recharge rate. For instance, if you were a pizza delivery place and you had this little electric car, you could plug it in while you were going in to pick up the next pizza, and by the time you came out, it would be charged ready for the next run. If you were a taxi cab, you could charge it, you know, while you're taking lunch break. And both of these battery technologies that we're working with now are smaller and lighter than the conventional. We're also working.
When you talk about recharge times of that order, you're talking about a very large current.
Yeah.
And a large flow of electricity. You have to have a special recharge station to be able to handle that.
Correct. For the quick recharge, you have to have a special recharge station, but it also has the ability to just plug into a regular outlet and charge at a lower rate.
So you'd have a couple of cords, basically?
Yeah. You'd have one that the recharge station would have a big heavy cord, like welding cables, to charge it quick, and then on the conventional slow charge, where you just charge it at night, you just plug it into either a 110 or an outlet, or if you wanted a faster charge, you could put it into a 220 outlet.
In terms of the amount of energy that would be drawing, would a household circuit, what's coming in from the municipality, would it even withstand that level of recharge, or would you have to have that in a commercial outlet?
No, a regular household outlet would charge it overnight at most applications.
But I'm not talking about the outlet. I'm talking about the service that comes into the house. If you had a special hookup to the box, for some reason the name of that is not coming to
mind. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Basically, if you could handle an electric dryer, you could handle the car.
Okay.
You wouldn't be drawing any more current than your electric dryer would draw.
Okay. And that would enable a 5 to 15 minute recharge time?
With the charging station, yes, because it would store the energy in the station and then dump it into the vehicle quickly. So it'd be kind of like having storage tanks that charge up at your charging station and plug it in and discharge it into the storage system quickly.
So your recharging station itself has battery capacity in it?
Yes, it would have to have battery capacity in it. So it would slowly charge that up, and when it's ready, you just plug in and you're charged and ready to go.
And you're saying that that specialty charter station would require the same kind of, in terms of what would plug into the house, be the same,
that's an electric dryer. Yeah.
Rating of wire is what goes to a dryer?
Yeah.
Now, on a larger scale, you know, if you pull up to a substation, obviously you're not going to need to have any kind of battery capacity. What kind of amperage are we talking about coming through those wires on a 5-kilowatt recharge?
Now you're looking at probably 200 to maybe even 250 amps. So that's the size of wires that the welding can use for, you know, their big heavy beam off or double off wire, that kind of stuff. And that would be for the quick charge. That's what I would expect to be put in charging stations if they're across the country. And I would even expect the charging station to have some storage capacity, because it would be cheaper to store the energy and fill up the charging station at lower usage times, particularly if you had like a wind generator to charge the storage system, and then you could take the storage system, plug it into the vehicle, and the vehicle's full and goes on down the road. The wind generator could then slowly recharge the charging station. You could charge it 24 hours a day when there's no vehicles in line.
So you could have a wind turbine with a number of recharging stations in queue, so to speak.
Yes.
And as each one finishes off, it goes to the next one, charges it, and customers can come to a refilling station, pick up a recharged unit, put it in their car, put theirs in queue to be recharged, and your refill takes a minute.
Yeah, there's multiple methods of that. We can exchange the recharge. We can do a quick charge with quick power dump into these cells. The cells that we're looking at, they have a unique property in that they do not generate heat charging or discharging. So because of that, they don't have a loss. They're kind of like a capacitor that way. And so with that, they can charge at whatever rate you can dump the power into them. And if you have that type of a system at your refill station, you have the ability to instantly recharge your vehicle based on the size of the wire you're feeding it with.
When you say extreme power, is that EX or is that with the X in the front?
EXTREAM, I believe.
EAM?
I believe that's what it is. I have their...
Is that John Bedini's group?
No, it's a group that that I contacted and we've been working with them for about a year now. They've been getting their production going, and we're just in the process of getting them one of our motors, and they're getting one of our power systems to do the final integration.
Okay.
I wish we had it here right now, but we don't have it here at this moment.
You were talking earlier about the retrofit. There were two versions. We talked about one where you would basically drop in a transmission that had the electric motor built into it to replace the transmission and turn the vehicle into a hybrid. What would be the second version of a retrofit?
The second version of a retrofit would be similar to the first, except we would put in a transmission and the electric motor and make it straight electric. And the determination
so would be remove the motor.
Yeah, remove the engine and transmission.
And the engine.
Yes. Remove them both and replace them both. That's what we're doing right now with our first one. We're going to be doing a large truck, 33,000-pound truck, and a large motorhome in the near future. The motorhome will be electric because the motorhome has a generator built in to run the motorhome. That will make it a hybrid. They'll be able to use the generator from the motorhome to recharge the battery and run it straight electric.
I'm counting three versions of retrofits. One is the transmission replacement. One is the engine replacement. The third is putting a motor in as well as a smaller engine that would run on fuel to recharge the batteries for longer hauls.
Correct. Correct. That would be what I would call a complete conversion with a long-range generator for traveling cross country. Now, there's actually another scenario. We have developed a very efficient hub motor. Now, a hub motor is different from a conventional motor in that the shaft is stationary and the motor housing turns around the shaft. In other words, okay. This is a format that could be built into the wheel of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so that creates one other retrofit option.
You say you're developing or you have developed that?
We have working prototypes that work wonderfully.
Let's talk for a minute about prototypes. How many, how long have they been tested, and have they been third-party tested?
We have some third-party testing on one of the prototypes. We have built probably 10 or 15 prototypes so far, maybe 20. And each one has had its purpose in improving and increasing the performance of the previous one. We're now at the point where we're in the process of building what we believe will be our actual production model.
Of which version?
Of all versions. We have a hub motor that we're building a production version of right now. We have and we have variations in the hub motor for various applications within that, and we have the conventional design motor. We have multiple sizes and applications for that. The nice part is we have common components in all of those, which makes our engineering time from one model to the next much quicker. If you go back to the days when they first came out with integrated circuits on computers rather than transistorized, the development of the next computer was much faster. And that's where we're at. We're at an integrated component motor module. We can take these independent components and produce motors of various sizes and shapes by just simply, how many do we want to put in here? How many does it need for this application? What's the correct diameter? What's the correct length? We do up the requirements and then we plug in place.
I would think that the first retrofit design you mentioned, while it's a great concept, in practice would be very difficult to implement because of a wide number of transmission sizes and fittings.
We have some ideas along those lines that might generate some comfort there. First of all, the retrofit scenario isn't necessarily our very first target market. Our very first market is a project that is very near completion. We're actually developing an electric vehicle for defense purposes. We hope to deliver that project and product within the next month or so. But in terms of the retrofit market, there's kind of some, I guess, call them sweet spots. It wouldn't make sense to go out and offer products for every make and model of every vehicle out there, you know, when we're first jumping out of the gate. But there are some products that have high demand. Take, for example, some of the larger, something like a Suburban or an SUV. If we were to focus on just a few vehicles where there's significant demand and then work our way into more vehicles, especially if we target vehicles where we have higher profit margins, it'll give us a sane launching point before we add to the complexity of our operation.
Transmission scenario, wouldn't you be able to come up with you'd have one, you'd have maybe four sizes to handle the range of torque requirements and speed requirements. And then you would have, with each one of those four sizes, you would have a number of marriage components so that you would fit your system to a Ford, your system to a Dodge, your system to a GM vehicle. And so all fitting to the same transmission motor assembly.
Correct. We have that in the plan. Our first step in that is rear-wheel drive, because rear-wheel drive gives us a wide range of vehicles and a very easy component to retrofit to. Our next beyond that is conventional type all-wheel drive vehicles, pickup trucks, SUVs, the larger vehicles, because of two reasons. The larger vehicles, number one, consume the most fuel and are going to be the easiest to retrofit. We have a design for a similar retrofit in front-wheel drive vehicles, but it's smaller, it's a tighter package. It's going to take more engineering and stuff, so that's further in the future. But as far as transmission sizes for the retrofit, we have them designed for vehicles as large as the big 18-wheel cross-country trucks, and all the way down to the size of an F-150 or F-250 Ford pickup, Dodge, Chevy, that size of vehicle.
The other factor that we have to work with here is our design is fundamentally scalable, flexible. It's almost like we have a set of building blocks, kind of like children's Legos. For us to take a new application and come up with a new motor that's a different size, different output, we can simply stack on one more rotor, for example. So with our standardized design format, as we need flexibility in additional versions, it's not very difficult for us.
And the transmission has those same design characteristics.
Okay. Now, when we talk about the range of size of torque output, I've got a question about the, just take one size. And
okay.
From what I understand, your design has has high torque at low RPM.
Yeah.
The usual reason for a transmission is because the engine usually cannot run at a low speed and produce torque. And
right.
So you've got to have a transmission to be able to convert a high RPM to a low RPM.
Right.
If your motor is able to produce a high torque at low RPM, why do you need a transmission?
Okay, the only reason for the transmission is with the transmission, we can increase the torque and have a smaller motor with a higher torque output. It's just a method of reducing the speed. It's also a method of our motors are capable of running up to the range of 5 to 10,000 RPM. Even though they put out the high torque at 0 or 1 RPM, because they have that high range, vehicle wheels don't turn that fast. And if they do turn that fast, you're going way faster than you can. So we want to put the transmission in there just so we can have a smaller package. It's a very convenient way because we do have the high RPM capability. Yeah. So
basically,
and our very small.
What is, if you were to look at a power curve of the performance of your motor, what is the sweet spot or the optimal running RPM for the motor?
Right now, that variable based on the design. But right now, the sweet spot, it's very flat. So it's not like on a conventional motor where this point is the best. It's a very wide spot, but it starts dropping off at about 3 to 4,000 RPM. It starts going down a little. So, you know, you want to get to the efficiency range, you want to be at 100 to 200 RPM, and you want to keep it between 100 and 200 and about 3 to 4,000. So that's our range of our sweet spot, where a conventional motor, that range might be 200 RPM, or with a wider, you know, with a gas engine, that might be wider. It might be as much as 500, maybe even 1,000 RPM, but ours is, you know, 3 to 4,000.
Now, on a different subject, you know, you're talking about all this work that you've done, the prototypes that you've built, and some of the customers that you have already. It would seem like you've had some fairly significant capital infusion. Could I ask what level of infusion you've had and how many different tranches?
You know, this project has been in development for many years. Over time, the infusion has been millions of dollars, but recently we've restructured our company to poise ourselves for a better ability to raise capital and to create a better, friendlier option should we decide to take the company public. So we are actually now operating in a brand new entity with limited financial history, but over time the injection has been substantial.
Can you give us some kind of idea?
About 5 million over time.
Okay.
Which isn't that much considering what's been done. But that's the cash. That's not counting the labor that's been involved.
When you say it doesn't count labor, that's because people are contributing time as a labor of love?
Yeah. There's been many hundreds and thousands of hours of volunteer labor working on this project.
Sounds to me like you're very close to going commercial. You're about ready to hit the copy button and start figuring things out and moving into the next and breaking into and making a big splash.
Yeah, that's correct. We've really just crossed the line between a really good idea that was promising into the category of commercially viable within the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we would be there sooner, but with the component failures we were having, design issues with the electronics, because of capturing this energy that's coming back from the coils, it was such a large amount of energy in comparison with what the conventional circuits were used to getting, and it was coming in such a quick time frame, we had to re-engineer and redesign all of our circuits, because as we turned the power up, the amount of power coming back went up at the same rate. And so our capture circuits failed. And when the capture circuit failed, it took out the power circuit. So we end up with a catastrophic failure. We had a failure in the system. We had to get some PhD and component engineering people in here to assist us in finding and solving the problems with our components.
Now,
it took about 6 months since we finished that, but we've had good functioning components that we've been able to test and verify that those things were in fact fixed.
One thing we've not addressed at all yet that is going to be a key question in people's minds in any technology is how it compares price-wise with the competitor.
But we'll give you some fundamental factors here and then go into some numbers just so it makes sense. But When we eliminated 99% of the iron out of the design and found ourselves in a position to move towards something like plastics or fiberglass or far less expensive components, the manufacturing cost and the cost of raw materials, of course, fall through the floor. So that's the first factor. Second factor is that our coil design is a very simple bobbin wound coil. So you're looking at something that's the equivalent of a bobbin that's used on a sewing machine. You've got a cylinder with wires wrapped around it. Now, if you compare that with the conventional motors, a very complex convoluted winding, you see another huge simplification of the design that leads to lower cost. Now, factoring that in, we have done all sorts of comparisons. Then, of course, we can do things like put out more torque, more horsepower in a smaller, lighter package that, you know, has simply less material altogether. But then, if you've done more research on the actual cost, I'll let you respond to that side of the equation.
The cost, based on our prototype production and doing pricing, if we build a motor in approximately 20 horsepower and up range, will be less expensive than any of the competitors. When we get below 20 horsepower, we have to go into mass production methods, which right now we're not yet to do. So until
so 20 or above, you can do somewhat of a one-off and be competitive. 20 horsepower below, you have to go into mass production in order to be competitive.
Yes, and at that point, when we go into mass production, 20 horse and below, we'll be able to beat them also, simply because of the winding mechanism required on conventional motors compared to what's required on this. Mm-hmm. Everything else we're comparable with, our material costs are going to be less. We can, you know, we can make this out of a piece of plastic, but they have to have the steel. The fabrication cost of plastic and injection molding is way cheaper than even forging or any of that in steel. And if they have to machine the steel, the price is even higher. So our production cost in an automated production assembly will be a fraction of what it is for the other motors.
Well, and that's the point right there is we have a design which is fundamentally easier to automate. There are parts of the conventional motor that in many typical designs cannot be automated due to the complexity.
Yeah, that's true of motors and generators. And right now we're in the process of working on this design to improve its generation capabilities, which is already extremely good. And that'll make it cheaper for motors and generators. So when somebody builds a wind turbine to produce electricity, by converting to our type of generator, it'll lower the cost of the generator, therefore lower the cost of the wind turbine.
When you talk about the recently, I mean in the last year, you've gotten to the point where you've crossed the line between a good idea and a commercially viable product. Time that you've had failures and burnouts and whatnot with your compounds is fairly recent. I would think that before going into mass production, there's going to be a requirement for some durability testing, longevity, stress testing of this product. How long and how rigorous is that phase of your development going to be?
Well, I'll answer that in a retroactive state. Many years ago, I was working on an aerospace project, and the aerospace project test to verify the product was ready to launch into space. And this was a product that's supposed to last, you know, 20 plus years in space. The testing cycle was 30 days. And at the end of the 30-day test cycle, when it passed, it was ready to launch. And so because we're not looking at a space project, the same level of testing for a ground-based piece of equipment can be done in about 15 to 20 days once we set it into that. Once we put it there, we put them in chambers and ovens, they can do analysis based on temperature rise and component materials and that kind of stuff to determine what its life will be under various applications by putting them in ovens and humidity chambers.
Now, beyond that, there are some markets where internal testing is always insufficient. Some people simply want to see third-party validation of these particular activities. Automotive is a good example. So in those cases, we will actually pay a third party to do 1 to 3 months of testing, depending on what needs to be done.
What kind of certifications are you going to need? I would think, for example, if you're dealing with electrical components here, that you need UL listing.
Okay. When there are applications where it will need the UL approval, and in those applications, we won't be able to deliver those until after we've got the UL approval. We have vendors who supply components to us that are UL approved. And by getting UL-approved components, it makes the final UL approval much quicker.
One of the members of our board has been through the UL approval process multiple times, so we have some insight into that scenario.
That always helps.
Yeah.
What other certifications are going to be required?
It's less about certification and more about the credentials of the third-party lab in those instances where that's required. In automotive, for example, there's two companies out there that do a very large percentage of the testing. We simply want to go to someone whose name will be recognized when they say it works, and everybody believes them. So that's less of a certification and more of a credible stamp of approval.
You mentioned that there were some applications where there wouldn't be any type of testing required. I'm having a hard time imagining any applications that would be that ilk.
Well, for instance, there's no or those types of requirements on farm tractors. So as we build an electric powered tractor, for instance, our internal testing would be adequate for that. They would the only thing that would be required in that arena would be a simple dynamometer test verifying the output. And wind power, the generator wouldn't require a lot of certification either. The box that takes that power, if you put it on the grid, would have to be certified. But the generator that actually puts the power into that box may or may not need any certification. So there are areas, battery-powered equipment that's low voltage doesn't require any certification. It's only when you get up above.
When you talk about a generator, you open up a new topic and a major question. Everything we've talked about up to this point has been taking an input current and turning it into an output torque.
Yeah.
But does your device work the opposite as well, taking input torque, such as from a wind turbine, and turning it into electricity as well?
Yeah, very effectively. In our testing, it does that extremely well, which has been a very good plus for us in the regenerative braking arena, because we can feed a very large amount of power back into the battery storage system. The nice part about it is it utilizes the same circuit that we use to capture the energy to reuse it. So we're getting double duty out of some of the components.
Is there any re-engineering required if it's serving as a generator versus as a motor?
There is some. There's a difference in the wire gauges you use as a generator and a motor simply because of the current that the generator you put out. That at the motor, the coils, if we allow the generator to put out the full current that it's capable of, it literally melts the coil in the motor if we use it that way. We have to limit its output. But that's not a problem. That's not a problem either. It's not that difficult to limit the output. but it requires a little bit different circuit design when we use it in that generator exclusively. Because if we turn it off too much, it'll just melt the windings down.
We touched on this earlier when we were talking about the regenerative braking.
Yeah.
And in that scenario, it's why is it not requiring a special redesign? Or is that going to be a different design than just a street motor? If it's all
no, no. The motor we have already has that part of the design completed. We have to limit how much regeneration braking we can do because we do too much of the hawk. And to damage it. Our circuit that does that has a thermocouple in the coil arena that's connected to the circuit, so it automatically shuts down its regeneration if the temperature gets too hot.
And so as I'm driving down the road and I have to slam on the brakes because the kid runs out in front of me, do you have a highly sophisticated circuit that says only run so much from regenerative braking and the rest from the pads on the wheels?
Yeah. Well, it's very complicated. Simple in that the regenerative braking will do what it can, and the brake pad will do the rest. So in an emergency stop, pretty much 99% of your braking will be from the pads. In a conventional stop, it would reverse. The 99% would be from the regeneration. That'll be based upon how hard you push on the pedal. When you push on the pedal, you'll turn on the regenerative braking. And if you push the pedal down further, it will give you a harder regenerative brake. And then beyond that, you'll hit the hydraulic portion of the brake. And at that point, you'll start playing pad pressure. So it's a very simple circuit. From a design standpoint, what it does is fairly complicated in that it does vary the amount of braking with the distance of the throw of the pedal initially. And once you get the pedal past the first portion, then you go into hydraulic braking.
And do you expect that with improvements in the design that you'll be able to up the amount that the regenerative braking could contribute to the emergency stopping scenario?
Oh, absolutely. With completion of improved design, I believe that it won't be long until we'll be able to have 100% of the braking regenerated. And the pads will only be there for parking and in case of a failure.
Well, I would think that portion of your design in the automobile industry would require many months of testing to prove to be valid and to meet with the stamp of approval before it goes into an assembly line.
Correct, and that would be the Department of Transportation approval that would have to be done. And that's why we're not doing all of that in our first level retrofit. We're simply using the conventional brake. When you let off the throttle, you go into regenerative braking, and it'll be limited regenerative braking. We have the method of going into a higher level of regenerative braking, and it's built into the vehicle, but it wouldn't be something that you would necessarily normally use, and that consists of you flip the vehicle into reverse and you apply throttle, and that increases the amount of regenerative braking than what we have.
So in your first phase, the first product you release, they'll be completely separate systems. You'll not try and have them talk to one another. One will be the motor, and as long as your foot is on the accelerator, it's going to be producing torque. When you let your foot off, it's going to say go into regenerative braking, and it's going to start slowing the vehicle down.
Right.
And then you tap your foot on the brake, that's going to increase the amount that you slow down. Otherwise, your regenerative braking will be 100% until you need to slow faster than that. And even while you're braking, the regenerative braking is still in place.
Correct.
proportional to the speed that you're going.
Correct.
And so the amount of energy you're recouping from regenerative braking in your first phase will be very little compared to something that might come, for example, from a Toyota Prius, which is designed for maximizing regenerative braking.
I'm not sure how it would compare with the Prius. That's something that we have to test. And that will depend a lot upon the driver, because when you let your foot completely off the throttle, you're going to go into a regenerative braking mode at a fairly high rate. The highest we can get without actually applying power to the regenerative braking system, which is kind of a strange way to think of it. We have to apply power to get more back.
I would think that if I'm driving down the road and I got my foot on the accelerator and I just all of a sudden get to the bottom of acceleration and I happen to be at the end of the bottom of the pedal and I don't realize that all of a sudden I'm going to be lurched forward in my seat because the regenerative braking kicks in. And like, oops, I didn't realize my foot was that far off the pedal. I would think that a better design would have the gradation on the back end so that you go from 0% to 100% regenerative braking over, let's say, half an inch, for example, of pedal movement.
Well, the way it works is your throttle position determines the power and the regenerative braking. If your throttle position is stable, you're just going to have power applied at that point. If you back off the throttle, you will get regenerative braking until you've reached that point. It won't be 100% regenerative braking unless you let your throttle all the way off, because the computer on the in the system tells it what speed that it wants to go, and it'll back off a percentage until it gets there. And during the back off time, it does regenerate braking. And it does it.
That sounds like a fairly sophisticated algorithm. How much time has been put into perfecting that component of the regenerative braking element?
It's it doesn't require very much. It's really quite simple, and that's already been built and tested in our system. So, and I didn't do the programming, so I don't know how complicated it was.
Do you have a vehicle that people could come and test drive?
We, the only vehicle we have moving right now is military, so it's classified so nobody can see it. But we're in the process of putting together a second one.
When will that be done?
Probably, oh, I'm going to guess between 20 and 30 days.
Okay.
This is actually our test platform vehicle, so it's done, and then it gets dissected and approved, and then it's done again, and right now we're in the middle of one of those improvement phases.
Yeah, so right now we're putting it together in an interim step to do some additional testing, and then it'll be taken apart, and then it should have the final version put in. It's been put together and ran up and down the road a few times. We actually had a second one that we had on the road for about a month, where they ran it every day around a, I think it was about a 4-mile loop, and did that for, I don't know the exact amount of time, but I was 3 to 4 weeks that it was ran on that loop, and it performed very well. They had a problem with the transmission of that one. They were trying to use conventional car transmission and didn't like it. The electric motor had too much torque for it. It broke two transmissions before we decided to scrap trying to use a conventional transmission with it.
Okay. Very good. Well, it's nice making your acquaintance, and we'll be in touch and move onward and upward from here.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.
Well, later. Thanks.
Bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.